No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show we'll start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. Maria, how are you? How are things in California?
Welcome. We're still, I guess, like the epicenter of COVID. My eldest, who did get it, got his first negative test result this week. Yay. And he also has the antibodies. So, there's some good in this. And thank you, Michael. What about you and your family?
Well, we're all doing great, except that I got on the website and it was so screwed up, I couldn't get through it. And so now I don't know what I'm going to do about getting a vaccination, but we're trying desperately. But other than that, Pat's been vaccinated.
Really?
Because she's a teacher.
Oh, right.
We're trying to get teachers back to work. Well, tonight we have a really interesting subject. We have Ellie Zutnick with us. And Ellie is an experienced communication strategist who has spent his career working with candidates and elected officials to help them win races and enact their policy and legislative agendas. He started a strategic communications consulting firm after 10 years in the United States Senate, including 6 years as a communication director for our friend Patty Murray from the other Washington, a good Democrat. And now he's the spokesman for Fix Our Senate, a coalition of liberal and labor groups formed to advocate for filibuster elimination, which has launched a six-figure ad campaign and plans to deploy field operatives in states where Democratic senators have expressed a reluctance to ditch the rule. Welcome, Ellie. Thanks so much for being on our show tonight.
Thank you, Senator. It's great to be here.
Can I ask you, can we start by you giving us a brief explanation of exactly what the filibuster is? We've all seen Mr. Smith goes to Washington. You know, we all understand that it's about extending debate. But can you give us a more of a clinical explanation of what it actually is?
Sure. Happy to. It's a good question. And it's something that's confusing to a whole lot of people. So when people talk about the filibuster, they're really talking about two separate things, and it's worth untangling them a little bit. First, as you note, people talk about the Mr. Smith goes to Washington or the famous Strom Thurmond filibuster of the Civil Rights Act, the idea that the filibuster is something that senators can go to the floor and they can talk as long as they want. They can read out of phone books and recipe books, and they do everything they can to try to delay a vote or draw attention to a vote. So that's what people mean when they say someone is filibustering. But the more insidious definition of a filibuster, and the kind that actually is causing all the problems right now, is the second version of a filibuster, or the second idea of what a filibuster is. And that, put simply, is the rule in the Senate that you cannot end debate unless you either get unanimous consent to end debate and go to a vote, or you can get 60 senators to agree with you to on a vote called a cloture motion to end debate and go to final passage. So this is what people mean when they say that the Senate needs 60 votes to pass anything, or that the bill couldn't get clear the filibuster hurdle or threshold. It's the idea that in today's Senate, which we can go into, is not the way it always was, a bill needs 60 votes or it gets filibustered and prevented from going to a final passage vote, and then it gets stuck in the Senate.
And am I right, this is not part of the structure of the Senate? It was actually, my understanding, is a rule that was pushed by Aaron Burr. I read some testimony from a woman from Brookings who said Burr bullied the Senate into accepting the rule. Is that your understanding as well?
That's exactly right. The Senate, when it was initially formed by the framers of the Constitution, was absolutely not a supermajority institution. It did not require 60 votes. It was a simple majority institution. It was like the House, a body that can pass legislation if it had a simple majority. In fact, the framers of the Constitution explicitly did not want a supermajority requirement in the Senate. They were moving away from the Articles of Confederation that had supermajority requirements. They couldn't get anything done under the Articles of Confederation, and they specifically wanted Congress and both chambers of Congress, the House and the Senate, to be able to move with a simple majority. What happened was, what you refer to was Aaron Burr, when he was vice president, shortly before he famously killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel, decided that in his role as vice president and president of the Senate, he would update the rule book of the United States Senate. He thought it was too cumbersome. There were too many rules. It needed updating since, 1787, 15, 18 years before that, when it was first codified, some of these rules. So he, the way the story goes, and you refer to Professor Binder, who wrote the book on the filibuster and the Senate rules, and who is an expert on these issues, the way she tells the story, It was an accident that Burr had wanted to update the rules and thought that the rule that allowed for what was called the previous question motion, which allowed them to come to a final vote and debate with a simple majority, he thought that was simply unnecessary. It was redundant. There was already a final passage vote. He thought, why did we need a vote just to get to the final passage that required 50? So he eliminated that. He cut it out. It wasn't for another 30 years or so, in the mid-1830s, early 1840s, that this ever became an issue. In that time, senators didn't realize that they could stop bills by just debating them forever. And it wasn't until Senator Calhoun actually wanted to stop a bill pushed by Senator Clay of Kentucky. It was a banking bill, but it, like everything those days, got pulled into the debate over slavery. And Senator Calhoun realized that he can stop this banking bill by just not letting it go to a final vote. It wasn't called a filibuster back then. The term filibuster wouldn't come into use until about 10 years later. But that was the first documented case of senators actually using this ability to extend debate forever. At that point, there was not even a cloture vote. There was no way at all. You couldn't end debate at all if you wanted to continue it. That didn't come about until 1917, when they actually put a rule in place that if you get, at that time, 2/3, and then it was reduced to 60, you could end debate. At that time, there was no way at all to end debate. So that's the way the filibuster came about. It was not intended to be there. It was an accident of history and updated rulemaking. And so I think when you hear today senators go around saying, this is a part of the institution, it's been there forever, it would destroy the institution if it was ever eliminated or changed, that's simply not true. It's a recent invention. It's evolved many times over the years, and we could get into how. And it's something that could change again, because it's simply not working.
Well, leave it to a politician to try to streamline the process and come up with a rule that makes everything more cumbersome. Maria?
So I'm curious about what you referred to in 1917, which was the Rule 22, which was the 2/3 majority, and then known as cloture. Can you go into how that came about? Why 2/3 versus the simple majority, and why it's not been used very often?
Sure, absolutely. So in 1917, there was a debate. It was a debate over around World War I, and President Wilson wanted to get, I believe it was a War Powers Resolution passed, and it was being filibustered in the Senate. And at that time, as I mentioned, there was simply no way to end debate. So President Wilson was able to push through Rule 22 in the Senate, which, as you referred to, is a rule that if senators can get two-thirds support to end debate, they can end debate and go to final passage. This is what the time, what they thought was a reasonable move away from unlimited debate with no ability to end it. It started, at least if you could get two-thirds, you could end debate and move to final passage. This, at that time, was still very rarely used. I alluded to this before, but this is something that post-Civil War was something, the filibuster was used almost exclusively to block civil rights bills, with some rare exceptions like the one around the War Powers Resolution. It was used to, you know, to perpetuate Jim Crow and white supremacy. Over 200 anti-lynching bills were killed in the Senate. They would have passed the House and been signed into law and died in the Senate because of the filibuster. So it's something that was used from, you know, around that Jim Crow period all the way through the 50s, the first Civil Rights Act, which was filibustered to water it down before it passed. And then Senator Thurmond's famous filibuster in 1964, that was finally broken by President Johnson to pass the big 1964 Civil Rights Act.
And then there was the legislation, if you will, I don't know if that's the right term, in 1975 when the Senate changed it from two-thirds to three-fifths?
That's exactly right. So at that, two-thirds was thought to be a reasonable move away from the inability to end debate at all, but it was still too cumbersome, and there was still, you know, at times, an inability for the Senate to move to final passage when an overwhelming majority supported a bill, and it should have been moved through the Senate and been able to be signed into law. So in 1975, the rules changed again to make it to bring that threshold down even further, from two-thirds to 60 votes, three-fifths.
And how did that come about? Is that something that the Senate moves and debates and then decides upon their own behavior? It's like they're self-policing, if you will?
That's exactly right. The Constitution gives each chamber the ability to make their own rules. And the way the rules can change in the Senate with a two-thirds majority. But that's, you know, and this is something that we can talk about, because there's a couple of different ways to change the rules in the Senate. The way it was changed in 1917 and 1975 was by actually changing the Senate rules and procedures, that specifically Rule 22 of the Senate that provides for the cloture motion and sets the threshold at which cloture is reached. But there's another way to change the rules of the Senate, and that's the way that Leader Reid did it in 2013. It's what Leader McConnell did in 2017. That is called what's commonly called the nuclear option. Some people call it the constitutional option because it's something that's available in the Constitution's prescribed ability of each chamber to set their own rules, as I mentioned before. What the nuclear option is that it allows the Senate to change the rules with a simple majority instead of two-thirds. Because the Senate is an institution that is run on precedent, unlike the House of Representatives that passes its rules every 2 years, every Congress there's a set of rules that's formally debated and passed, the Senate doesn't do that. Its rules carry over from one Congress to the next, and the presiding officer, guided by the parliamentarian, will advise on the current precedent and weigh in on, does this vote need 50? Does this vote need 60? Does this vote in some cases need more than that when it comes to issues like impeachment and expelling members of the Senate? But what the so-called nuclear option allows is it allows the Senate to override the ruling of the presiding officer and overturn a precedent so that a new precedent is created. So in 2013, when Minority Leader McConnell was holding up basically every one of President Obama's nominees, he wouldn't let him pass sub-cabinet level nominees, judges, wouldn't let him fill boards like the National Labor Relations Board. And at some point, Leader Reid and President McConnell just had enough, and the government couldn't function with the kind of obstruction that Minority Leader McConnell was doing. And so they changed the rules. They brought up a vote on the nominee. It was a judge, I believe, and the cloture vote came up short. It did not get 60 votes. At that point, Democrats didn't have 60 votes in 2013. And Leader Reid called for a reversal of the ruling of the presiding officer, which got over 50 votes and set a new precedent. From that point forward, nominees at every level except Supreme Court no longer needed a 60-vote requirement, a 60-vote threshold for passage. They now needed a 50-vote threshold. That was the new precedent, because he had set that, and the Senate is allowed to set their own rules. Leader McConnell then did the exact same thing in 2017 when Democrats filibustered now Justice Gorsuch. He immediately did the exact ran the exact same play as Leader Reid, called for overturning the precedent, the ruling of the chair, to set a new precedent, and with his simple majority was able to change the rules of the Senate so that Supreme Court nominees no longer could be filibustered.
So do you think, given that what you just said, Ellie, that there might be some compromise short of getting rid of the filibuster, where senators might be able to set a new rule that says certain things can fall under a nuclear option type of consideration? Now it seems that is somewhat arbitrary. But could the Senate get together? Do you see any chance that the Senate could say, in cases of civil rights or in cases of nominations or in cases of this or that, that they automatically suspend the rules? Is that a possibility?
It is. The Senate can set precedent, just like Leader Reid narrowed the changing of the precedent to only include nominees below the Supreme Court level. They can do something similar when it comes to legislation and set a narrow new precedent so that, as you noted, certain legislation or certain kinds of policies could move with a simple majority. That's not what we're advocating for. With the Fix Our Senate coalition, we think that the filibuster is so broken and has become a tool of pure partisan obstruction at this point. Whatever you thought of it before, whether you thought it was a helpful tool to promote compromise and bipartisanship, or you never did at all, I think it's clear, and I think the evidence shows that it's clear, that it's no longer working. I think Jeff Merkley of Oregon, one of the leaders in fighting to eliminate the filibuster, has made the point often, if the filibuster is supposed to increase bipartisanship, we're seeing more filibusters than ever before, why aren't we seeing more bipartisanship? I think it's clear that the Senate isn't working. I think it's pretty clear that the filibuster is a big part of what's preventing it from working. So we think we should get rid of the filibuster. It doesn't mean an end to bipartisanship. It doesn't mean that Democrats or Republicans couldn't and shouldn't continue working together. It just means that you take this tool of partisan obstruction away from the minority and force them to actually come to the table knowing that things are going to get done if the majority can muster 50 votes plus one to get it over the line.
What about the criticism that the Senate is supposed to be more deliberative and act as a bulwark in a certain, to legislation? It's not supposed to be exactly like the House of Representatives. What do you say about that?
Sure. That's a point that's brought up a whole lot. And, I think that there are senators who are talking about changing the filibuster and eliminating the filibuster. Senators like Senator Merkley, Senator Warren, and others have talked a lot about the ways that they would make sure that it doesn't move to simply becoming a rubber stamp or becoming just a place where bills are pushed through with no deliberation or debate. Senators would absolutely be able to still deliberate, debate. Members could still go to the floor. They could go to the floor for hours. There would be nothing stopping them from having those debates. There would be nothing stopping compromise, certainly. There would be nothing stopping members from working together and trying to get something done in a bipartisan way. But what it would do is it would make sure that that comes to an end at some point, that at some point when deliberation and debate is concluded, when it's been hashed out, whether it's a few days on a minor issue, a few weeks on a major issue, that there is a conclusion that the filibuster can't be used to simply block at full stop and say, we will not allow this to move. That at the end of the day, after all the deliberation, all the debate, a vote is called and it's yes or no. And the senators vote up or down. And if a majority supports it, it moves through. And it eliminates the ability of the minority to just block everything and make sure that the majority, which is the party that is held accountable for actually making the Senate work, that the majority that is held accountable has that ability, has the power to do that and to actually deliver on the promises that they made to voters.
So, Ellie, yes, thank you. I know that you're involved in fixoursenate.org. Can you tell our listeners about that and how they can get involved too?
Absolutely. So Fix Our Senate is a coalition of a number of progressive groups, from Communications Workers of America to Public Citizen, Protect Our Care, Sunrise Movement, Indivisible, a number of others. You can go to fixoursenate.org and see the full list of our coalition, and it's a growing coalition, and more will be added in the coming weeks. We formed because we think that the Senate isn't working and that the filibuster is a major part of what is breaking the Senate, that specifically the filibuster under Senator Mitch McConnell, who was majority leader and is now minority leader, that in his hands, the filibuster has become that tool of pure partisan obstruction and is causing the Senate to be a graveyard for legislation across the board, from health care, workers' rights, now COVID relief, democracy reforms, name your issue, and it's something likely that is being blocked in the Senate right now. And we came together to organize and educate people about why the filibuster is a problem, what could be done, and what the solution is to eliminate the filibuster and move to a simple majority in the Senate, and helping people connect the dots between the issues that they care about, whether it's gun safety or immigration reform or raising the minimum wage, D.C. statehood, other democracy reforms like getting money out of politics or ending gerrymandering, connecting the dots between those issues and the process that is a brick wall in front of them, the filibuster that's stopping progress on any of those and many other issues. So we know that people, at the end of the day, most people don't and shouldn't care about Senate procedure. Not something that people wake up every day, other than me and a few other people. It's not something that people wake up every day and think about, nor should they. But they do care about their health care. They do care about their jobs. They do care about our democracy and what we're all seeing happen to it, from the events of a couple weeks ago, but before that as well. And people want results. People want things to change. People just voted for Democrats in the White House, in the House, in the Senate, to get things done, to deliver results, to fix some of these problems, and to make progress on these policies. But I don't think people understand that even though they put Democrats in charge of government, Leader McConnell and the minority Republicans in the Senate still have a veto and still could block everything. And we just don't think that's right. We don't think that's democratic. We don't think we know that that's not what the founders intended. And at this point in our history, with everything going on in our country and so many crises and so much work that needs to get done on so many fronts, we think that this has boiled over to the point where we can make progress and that senators are ready to make a change and deliver results, because if they don't, the alternative is another 2 years of gridlock and dysfunction, and we don't think our country can afford that.
So do you consider yourself Fix Our Senate? Are you bipartisan? Or I know you're a Democrat strategist. But what you're talking about sounds reasonable. And me as a registered Republican, I'm not getting or feeling any resistance to what it is that you're saying. And how are you going about this other than formats such as our program? Are there focus groups or grassroots? And again, how can our listeners get involved?
Sure. We're a progressive coalition, but we are not a partisan coalition. And we think there's every reason for Republicans to agree. We think there's every reason for moderates on both sides of the aisle to agree. If you think that government is working perfectly fine the way it is, if you think that everything is fantastic in the country right now, then we're probably not going to have a message that is going to motivate you or is going to inspire you. But if you think that the Senate isn't working, you think that government isn't working and it's not delivering results, then I think we have a message that maybe could speak to people from all sides, from all parts of the spectrum and all both political parties. I think Democrats and Republicans, there's a lot of agreement that things are broken. I think there's disagreement about a whole lot of policies. I think there's disagreement sometimes about who is to blame or, who's doing what at any given moment. But I think there's general agreement that things aren't working. And I would hope that there could be some agreement about what can be done to fix the systems and fix the structures. It's not just going to help Democrats. It's something that when Republicans are in charge, they should be able to pass the things that they campaigned on. If voters put them in charge, You know, they, President Obama, President Trump was able to pass his tax cuts. He was able to, with a simple majority, and for reasons I can explain, but he was able to use a procedural tool to bypass the filibuster with tax cuts. He was able to, as I mentioned before, confirm his Supreme Court nominees with a simple majority because the filibuster was eliminated on Supreme Court nominees. There are a number of areas where the filibuster has been eliminated, but not areas that are so critical to so much of the work that needs to get done. I mentioned democracy reform. I know you and so many of your listeners, Senator, care a whole lot about D.C. statehood, economic issues, healthcare issues. Those are issues that, you know, they need, a whole lot of them need the elimination of the filibuster or nothing's going to get done.
Well, you know, I would tell you, Ellie, that not only you wake up dreaming about the elimination of filibuster, but everybody that's for D.C. statehood also does, as we discussed briefly before the show, although elimination of the filibuster certainly wouldn't guarantee statehood, it really is the major obstacle that we see standing in our way right now. We're not going to get 60 votes. We've never gotten a Republican in the Senate to endorse a statehood bill. So it's a real obstacle for us. But let me follow up on Maria's question. I looked at your website and I see that you're targeting Democrats who have shown a resistance to join your campaign to eliminate the filibuster. Is that because you see that as the path of least resistance?
That's right. And I think it's not a matter of targeting them. It's a matter of helping their constituents connect the dots between those issues that they care about and making sure that people in their home states and in many cases these senators themselves are getting the latest and getting up to speed on the facts that we discussed before, the fact that it's not a part of the Senate history, the fact that, you know, when some members, senators come to the floor, most notably Minority Leader McConnell, and try to make the case against eliminating the filibuster because he is very, very interested in keeping the filibuster as his tool of keeping power while he's in the minority, helping people understand that the things that he's saying are often just not true, and helping those constituents, as I said before, connect the dots between the issues they care about and the issues that some of these senators are promising them. Many senators go around and make big promises to their constituents, and I think it's fair for constituents to be able to ask them, how are you going to deliver on them? Does this mean you're going to support eliminating the filibuster, or are you just going to let the filibuster stand and let these policies die? So we're making sure that people across the country understand this, connect the dots. We're running advertisements across the country. We're working to activate grassroots supporters. We're supporting groups in D.C. and also in states across the country that are focused on issues, groups like Brady Campaign, which is, you know, a member of our coalition. They're a group that's focused on gun safety, and they understand very well that if the filibuster stands, there is no chance that that common sense gun safety legislation will make it past the NRA and the NRA's supporters in the Senate. They're going to filibuster it. That's what they did in just a few years ago when Senator Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, Senator Toomey, a Republican of Pennsylvania, they came together on a common sense background check bill that was supported in some polls, showed over 90% of the American people supported it. It was filibustered in the United States Senate. It got 53 votes, didn't get 60, would have passed the House and been signed into law, and we could have had a good step in the right direction on gun safety. Those kind of things simply aren't possible in a world where the filibuster exists, and we want to make sure people are connecting those dots and have the tools and information they need to reach out to their senator and ask, what are you going to do about it?
Well, you know, I find it interesting that some of the people that have spoken about resistance to removing the filibuster, Democrats, are also people that have never signed on to a statehood bill for the District of Columbia, like Senator Manchin of West Virginia, who is a Democrat but tends to act more like a Republican, I think, on most occasions, and Sinema from Arizona, and John Tester. John Tester actually signed on to a statehood bill, but it was very late on. I think that's very interesting. And we want our movement, the statehood movement, certainly wants to do whatever we can to help you, Ellie, because, you know, as you say, the legislation that we want to see happen is really going to be held down by the filibuster. Go ahead, Maria.
So
do
I'm
you have
curious.
Another question?
Yes, because our listeners are usually also activists for DC for statehood. And both of you are in agreement that the filibuster would prevent DC to become a state. Can you explain how that works, how that would work, or why that's possible?
Which one are you asking us?
Both of you, because you have a common understanding that's eluding me.
Okay, go ahead, Ellie. You first.
Sure, I'm happy to kick it off. So, as I'm sure your listeners know, the House has the votes to pass DC statehood, H.R. 51. Delegate Holmes Norton has introduced it. It has the votes to pass. If it were introduced in the Senate, as the senator noted, it is. I couldn't say. You would know better than I if it has 50 votes right now. You could speak to that, Senator. But what I can say is that it absolutely does not have 60 votes. And there are not 10 Republicans who would agree to let D.C. statehood or so many other bills get a simple up or down vote. They would filibuster it. They would block it. They would not let it come to a final passage. It would simply die in the Senate if it were even brought up. Because what happens with the filibuster is that because there are so many things that need to get done, so many nominees that need to be confirmed, so many bills that need to be passed, often bills that are going to be filibustered simply never even make it to the Senate floor. It's something that we saw with the Waxman-Markey bill, for example, in 2009, 2010. It was a climate change bill that passed the House. It never saw the light of day in the Senate because they knew it would be filibustered. Similarly, we see that all the time with bills in the Senate. So unless the filibuster is eliminated and there are 50 votes, then bills are simply not going to be able to pass. But that's a key, very important point. And this was, the senator alluded to this, and we touched on it before. Bills that just because you eliminate the filibuster, that's not a magic trick that gets you everything that you want. It doesn't mean that the things that you want, or even the things that the leader of the party, the president of the United States, supports, will automatically get done. You still need 50 votes plus one, whether it's 51 votes or 50 votes plus the vice president, to get a bill passed through the Senate. So that means if D.C. statehood, for example, doesn't have 50 votes, it's not going to pass. It means that unless you can bring members on board, many of whom are moderate members, members like Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema, Senator Tester, and many, many others are moderate members who are interested in working across the aisle, who are interested maybe in more moderate approaches, you still need them. So it's not some kind of, a lot of times you'll hear that Leader McConnell and Republicans and sometimes conservative activists or columnists will try to say something like, if you get rid of the filibuster, that means you're going to pass some kind of socialist agenda. First of all, I don't think anyone thinks President Biden ran on a socialist agenda, but even if he did, of course he did not, you couldn't pass that through the Senate. You still have to get the votes of 50 Democrats in a Senate that includes a number of very moderate Democrats who come from red states and who are going to be interested in passing legislation that they support. So, again, I think this, it all gets back to the idea that you getting rid of the filibuster doesn't guarantee that you pass bills, but if the filibuster exists, you're guaranteeing that you don't.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I couldn't say it any better. There has been a bill now, S-51, introduced in the Senate, and there are several Democrats that have never been on a statehood bill. But the truth of the matter, and you know this, Maria, because we had the one congressman from Maryland who has ever supported a statehood bill who was a Republican. Mm-hmm. So there's never been a Republican in the Senate to support statehood. And there's only been one in the history of the House. So the idea that we could get to 60 votes by convincing 10 Republicans just seems to be non-existent.
It's the 60 votes is to get to end the filibuster and right. to call for a vote, right. and then you need a simple majority to right. to vote. So right. so it's a two-step process. So if you were to abolish the filibuster, how do you go about that?
It ends up being in my opinion, a necessary but not a sufficient condition. So it's a necessary condition for us to put ourselves in a position where we could get 50 votes. So you're right, Maria, we would have to convince several Democrats, four Democrats at last count on the last bill, four Democrats to come over to our side, Manchin being one of them, and Sinema being another. So, and there's also Sheldon Whitehouse, and I forget who the fourth is. But so, yes, we'd have to convince them, and then we'd have to, you know, we'd have to have all the other Democrats. Right now, I think there were 34 or 39 original introducers. So there's still 11 Democrats out there that we'd have to convince. Mm.
And Maria, the way it would work, I think, just to lay it out with a specific example. So setting aside statehood, because you know that's one where maybe it's still a little bit unclear where the votes could fall. Take an issue like H.R. 1, the For the People Act. This is the bill that Democrats have introduced in the House, will be introduced or was introduced just recently in the Senate, that would tackle money in politics, gerrymandering, and you know do a number of democracy reforms that are pretty common sense. Most people think seems to be pretty well understood that this has, you know, pretty much unanimous, if not unanimous, support among Democrats in the Senate. It would pass in wide margins in the House. If it came up for a vote in the Senate, it would get filibustered. We know that. We know Senator McConnell, one of the things that he has made clear over the course of his career is that he fights off attempts to take money out of politics. It's something that, for whatever reason, ideological, political, or anything else, he does not think there should be limitations like that on money in politics. So it would come up for a cloture vote to end the debate and move to final passage, and it would fail to get 60. Leader McConnell would hold his Republicans together, and they would block this bill. It would not get 60 votes. What would then happen if Democrats decide to end the filibuster, to move past this weapon of obstruction, would be Leader Schumer would, just like Leader McConnell did in 2017 and Leader Reid did in 2013, call for a vote to overturn the ruling of the chair, because the chair would say, based on the precedent set in the Senate, that legislation needs 60 votes to get cloture and end debate, that this vote failed. Leader Schumer would then ask to overturn that ruling and set a new precedent, and he would then call a vote. And if a simple majority of 50 Democrats plus the vice president agree with him that there should be a new precedent, the ruling of the chair is overturned. And from that point forward, legislation would only require 50 votes, a simple majority, to get cloture and move to final passage, which would then also just require a simple majority. So that's kind of the technical procedural way it would happen.
Well, let me ask you, Ellie, if you could explain to us, earlier you referred to President Trump getting his tax policies through using a reconciliation, I believe. So why is it that reconciliation, you can use reconciliation for things like that, but you can't use reconciliation for other things?
That's a great question, and it's one that's going to come up a lot in the next couple of weeks. There's going to be a big debate about what can go in reconciliation, what cannot go in. But to take a step back, reconciliation is a process that was first, it was put into law in the 1974 Budget Act. The original intent of reconciliation was that Congress would set a budget at the beginning of the Congress. The House and the Senate would each pass their budget resolutions that would set spending levels and tax levels for each of the different areas, each of the different committees and appropriations committees. And then they would implement legislation over the course of that Congress that adhered to that budget resolution. The 1974 Budget Act put in place this process called reconciliation to give Congress tools to reconcile subsequent bills to those initial budget numbers, that if they would set spending and tax levels at the beginning of the Congress, they would actually have a tool in place to reconcile those numbers and to make them actually adhere to the budget. So the way that worked was because the biggest hurdle to any kind of legislation moving is the filibuster, the 1974 Budget Act put in place a process that did not allow a filibuster. It cut off the ability to filibuster a reconciliation bill with the idea that if Congress had already agreed on a budget resolution, they should then be able to move quickly on legislation that reconciled the actual spending and taxation levels with what they had already agreed to in the budget. So there was this procedure that was put in place in 1974 and was used pretty much in a straightforward way as envisioned for the initial years, through the 70s and 80s. It wasn't until, the 80s, 90s, and then certainly in 2000 and beyond that it began to be used in a much different way. It began to be used to try and to push policy that wasn't truly envisioned in the 1974 Act when they got that signed into law. There's strict rules. Senator Byrd, you'll hear over the coming weeks something called the Byrd Rule. Senator Byrd, in 1984, 1985, he was worried that things were starting to be abused in reconciliation and extraneous policies, extraneous legislation. Senators were trying to push him into reconciliation because they knew if they got it into a reconciliation bill, it wouldn't be subject to the 60-vote filibuster threshold. So Senator Byrd, who is a stickler for the Senate rules, put in place what's called the Byrd Rules, which really limited what can be put into reconciliation. It couldn't increase the deficit beyond 10 years. A number of other, it couldn't touch Social Security. It couldn't be a policy issue with budgetary impacts that were, quote, merely incidental, which was to limit policy legislation from being put into reconciliation bills and limit it to simply budget policies, moving numbers up and down. And, but over the years, many parties, Democrats and Republicans, have put policies that they campaigned on and they cared a lot about into reconciliation bills. The 2001 and 2003 Bush tax cuts were done through reconciliation. Democrats couldn't filibuster them. They were passed. A number of Democrats ended up voting for them, but they only needed a simple majority. Famously, after the passing of Senator Kennedy in 2009 or 2010, after he passed away and Democrats were down to 59 votes after Senator Brown won in Massachusetts, President Obama passed the final pieces of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, through reconciliation with a simple 50-vote majority threshold and couldn't be filibustered. President Trump passed his big tax cut that went primarily to big corporations and wealthy Americans and some others with a simple majority through reconciliation. So it has become a tool that both parties have used to pass a budget-related tax policy and spending policy bills while getting around the filibuster. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with reconciliation. Both parties use it. It has a goal. And I think I support bills passing with a simple majority. So I think a process that allows things to pass with a simple majority is a good thing. But what I think it highlights is how silly it is that you can do some things with reconciliation just because they happen to fall into a Senate procedure that wasn't really intended to work this way. So you can pass tax cuts, you can pass some health care expansion provisions that are good things, you can pass spending increases primarily on what's called the mandatory side, but you can't do things like make D.C. a state, you can't get money out of politics, you can't do comprehensive immigration reform, gun safety legislation. Many people think you can't raise the minimum wage, although there's some debate over whether that could be put into reconciliation. So it's kind of an arbitrary way that allows the Senate to be able to move very quickly on some pieces of legislation, mostly around budget and economy, but that completely leaves behind civil rights, voting rights, democracy reforms, and so many other critical policies that need to move because they just, the filibuster is still in place and the filibuster stops all that.
I looked at your website and it said that your top priority was elimination of the filibuster. But are there other priorities as well? Are there other things that you guys plan on working on?
This is our highest priority and first priority. For us, this is the key that unlocks the door. Right now, the door is locked. Nothing can move past the Senate. It's a brick wall, to mix metaphors a little bit. But once we unlock that door, of course there's going to be more work to do. There's a lot of things that need to happen to make the Senate work a little bit better. Hopefully many of them will be addressed when we eliminate the filibuster. That would also eliminate unintended consequences like hidden holds and other ways, that kind of secretive ways that senators can slow down the process because of the implicit threat of a filibuster and the fact that you need unanimous consent to make anything move quickly in the Senate. So there's a whole lot of ways that senators could slow down bills and stop things altogether with the threat of a filibuster. But there's other things that can be done to fix the Senate. I mentioned Senator Merkley before. He's one of the leaders in the Senate in thinking through and working with members on ways to make the Senate work better, allow more amendments, allow a more deliberative process. You know, there have been ideas that have been reported in the press about things like allowing bills that move in a bipartisan basis through committee to get some kind of expedited procedure in the Senate floor. I don't know if those are things that we're going to be working toward. I don't know. We haven't gotten to that stage yet. Step one is get rid of the filibuster, start, unlock that door. And then once we unlock that door, there's a whole lot of work that needs to get done once we start walking through.
Ellie, what kind of opposition do you have against what it is that you are endeavoring to do?
Primarily, the opposition is coming from the Republican minority. And, you know, I would say they are backed and supported by a number of special interest groups that are very, very focused on maintaining the status quo. There was a letter that just came out from conservative advocacy groups, Heritage Action, Americans for Tax Reform, that group of conservative advocacy organizations who want a smaller government, who don't want legislation to pass, who are happy with the status quo, and who know that the filibuster is the best tool they have to make sure that when Republicans are in the minority, they could still block things from happening that they don't like. So that is our primary opposition. We know that they are going to be gearing up and spending money and working hard to defeat any attempt at reform. We know that Senator McConnell cares a lot about preserving the filibuster. We saw just about a week ago now, he tried to, in his first act as minority leader, force Senator Schumer to guarantee that the filibuster would never go away, that it would be enshrined in what's called an organizing resolution to get the new Senate moving again and to get the committee set up. He failed at doing so, but I think he showed his hand, and he showed how committed he is to preserving the filibuster, how desperate he is to maintain this tool that he has to exercise a veto from the minority. And I think he's going to have a lot of support from his caucus, who have shown that they're pretty united on this and don't want to respect the will of the voters. They want to maintain their power from the minority. And I think he's going to have a lot of support from those special interest groups and the industries and big donors who benefit from the status quo and who don't want to see change.
What about the president? I've heard that President Biden has concerns about eliminating the filibuster. He was in the Senate, elected to six terms in the Senate, and I read in the paper recently that he's not sure what he wants to do. Do you have any read on him?
I don't have any read on him beyond what's been reported. But what I can tell you is that a couple of things. First, he has said publicly, and you know, he has said wherever he has gone, that he wants to get big, bold things done this year. Yeah. He knows there's a crisis. He has said he wants to get bold things done. When he was asked about the filibuster a number of months before the election, he said he has been a longtime supporter of the filibuster, but if Republicans prove to be obstreperous, that was the word he used, if they prove to be obstreperous, then he would have to take another look at it. And what that signaled, which came just around the time that President Obama made his speech calling the filibuster a Jim Crow relic that should be eliminated if it got in the way of progress on civil rights issues and voting rights issues, that was interpreted by many as President Biden signaling that, yes, he still supports the filibuster. Yes, he still wishes that we had a world where Republicans would come to the table and the filibuster didn't need to be changed because we can get 60 votes on common sense bills that help the American people and help workers and families. But if Republicans use it as a weapon, if they prove to be obstreperous and just stop everything and block his agenda the way they tried to block President Obama's agenda back in 2009 when Leader McConnell set his top priority, I think he said this a little later, but his top priority was making President Obama a one-term president. If they use it as a political weapon, the indications that he's, what my read, and I think a lot of people are reading this from his public comments and what his staff is saying, is that his patience is going to wear thin. And part of what we're trying to do, and a number of other organizations and activists and advocates and people across the country are trying to do, is, you know, put some pressure on to speed that up. If Republicans are gonna be obstreperous, let's force that choice now. Are they going to work with him? That's great. It would be fantastic if they came to the table and worked with him to deliver on the promises that he made to people. And he has signaled in no uncertain terms that he is open to compromise and wants to work with them to get things done. But if they're not, if they just want to do what they did in 2009, where they promised up and down, they swore every day they wanted to work with President Obama on health care reform. They spent months and months negotiating it. They said they just needed more time. And in the end, they left him standing there by himself. And they showed back then that if you can make the party in power look bad by not delivering what they promised, you can win. Republicans won back the House in 2010. They won back the Senate in 2014. And I think that was in part because they realized that the party in power is accountable for delivering results, and the minority has the ability to prevent that from happening. So my read on this, and again, this is just based on what I'm seeing in the press, what everyone else is seeing, is that President Biden wants to get things done. He's not going to have much patience for obstreperousness, and we're going to see pretty soon there's going to be Republicans are going to face a choice, work with President Biden or not, and then Democrats are going to face a choice. Do they spend 10 years doing absolutely nothing and just complaining about the gridlock and dysfunction, or do they deliver results for their constituents and fix this broken Senate and get rid of the rule that's just not working anymore?
Well, Ellie Zupnik, we're running out of time here. Please tell, I think you've been a great guest, and this has really been informative. And tell people how they can get to your website so that they can get more information.
Absolutely. And first I'll say that if this was the Senate, I would just be able to keep talking, and there's nothing you could do to stop me. I'm glad that, that we have a limit. as much as I've enjoyed this.
Sure.
But people should go to fixoursenate.org or on Twitter at fixoursenate. To see updates from us, see how you can get involved, sign up for our mailing list, and we'll keep you updated on what we're doing in the months ahead.
Okay.
And do you want to give a plug to Singularity Communications?
Oh, that's okay. The most important thing people could do right now is focus on the work that needs to get done to fix the Senate, move the policies that our country needs. I think, you know, I'm happy to be a part of Fix Our Senate and to work to advance their goals and certainly support any help we can get. People who want to advocate, talk to their senator, be a part of our group, however people can help, we will find a way to plug you in. So reach out to us, go to our website. There's lots of ways to connect with us, and we'll find ways to help to get you to help.
And we should add that the term filibuster is a Dutch word that means pirate. So does that say it all?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you again, Ellie. You've been a great guest.
Yes, thank you.
Hope you'll come back again, maybe to celebrate the elimination of the filibuster someday. So as we progress along the path, we hope you'll come back again and be on the show again. But thanks so much for being here tonight.
Thank you for having me. Have a good night.
You too. Good evening. Yeah. We have to thank our listeners, as always. New year, new listeners, shares, and people are listening through all of, not just live, but downloading and on demand. And it's really an honor that our reach is getting bigger and bigger, and it's thanks to the word of mouth. So thank you, Michael, for all of that.
Well, and thank you, Maria. And we should announce that next week we'll be playing some wonderful rerun because Maria Sanchez and Michael Brown are rabid
huge NFL fans.
Yep. We're not going to miss the Super Bowl, and we don't want any of you guys to miss the Super Bowl either.
Yes.
So tonight we're going to leave you with a song. We always do that. And here's a song from Diana Ross, Florence Ballard, and Mary Wells, better known as the Supremes, dedicated to the filibuster. Here's Stop in the Name of Love.
Stop in the name of love before you break my heart. Won't you stop? Baby, baby, I'm aware of where you go. Each time you leave my door, I want to Give the people their right to vote.